says that one of the duties of the messengers and the prophets is وَيَحْتَجُّ عَلَيْهِمْ بِالتَّبْلِيغِ, that they complete the arguments for the people through tabligh, through propagation. And we mentioned about that in the previous session. In today's session, we will mention another duty of the messengers and the prophets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is وَيُثِيرُوا لَهُمْ دَفَائِنَ الْعُقُولِ, that the prophets and messengers, they, what they do is that they awaken, or they, you can say, they cause a movement and a sudden change, or they, we can say, they push forth, or they bring forth, bring it forward, take forward, bring about change, or force a change, or you can say, cause a revolution, something like that. Ithara means to cause something to happen, to bring about a change or something like that. So here Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَيُثِيرُوا لَهُمْ دَفَائِنَ الْعُقُولِ, which means that to cause those hidden matters of the intellect to rise up, to cause them to come forth, okay, to rise up, meaning that these things are hidden, some intellectual matters are hidden, and the prophets come and they kind of bring them forth so the people can witness them and can make use of them.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, this statement of Imam Ali alayhi salam shows that there is a very powerful, very, very great treasure that exists within the human essence, within the human soul, within the human communities, let's say, which is the treasure of intellection, the treasure of being able to understand things, to think and to ponder and to analyze things. But this is kind of hidden. It is covered up. It has been buried, basically. Dafa'in means, it comes from dafina, means that which is buried. Dafa'inul uqul means those aspects of the intellect, those intellectual matters that have been buried. You see? So it shows that there are certain aspects that have been buried, which the prophets come and remove them and bring them forth. And yes, unfortunately, when hegemonic powers take over nations, they take over societies and countries, then this particular thing happens, that these intellectual matters and people's intellectual capacities and their capacity to analyze and to understand are buried. Otherwise, all human beings have the capacity to understand, to contemplate, to think, to analyze. Okay? They have that intellectual capacity of a human being. All of them have. But sometimes you will notice certain communities make lesser use of this faculty, and they are not well known for analysis and use of the intellect, while others are more prominent in this field. Why does that happen? Inshallah, we shall discuss in the coming segment.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, what happens is that sometimes you notice that a certain particular group of people, they feel that they aren't understanding. Their understanding capacity is weak. Or you may have come across some communities that when you speak to them about certain issues and make them try to understand something, they just don't understand. They just don't understand that thing that which is told to them. Why is it? Is it because they belong to a certain sect or they belong to a certain caste or a certain race? No, that's not the case. The problem is certain communities of the world have been suppressed such their intellectual capacities are not coming forth. If you notice when Dhul-Qarnayn, who according to some of the scholars was a prophet, let's say, when he comes to this community, one of the communities that was an oppressed and suppressed community, he says that they could not understand anything. When they were being told things, they were not able to understand. Probably this is alluding to the fact that because of their extreme oppression, this community had felt that they cannot think, while the prophets come and they remove those covers and those intellectual matters that are buried so that they now start to think and contemplate. And even today, unfortunately, if you ask certain groups of people, they will tell you that, you know, in our opinion, we are, let us say, a lower caste of people, and there is a higher caste of people that is more powerful in its thinking, which is incorrect. Absolutely. In terms of the intellectual capacity, in terms of the ability to analyze and to recognize and to become aware and to know, all human beings are equal in their capacity. They have the ability. All communities can. It is those communities that are more closer to the wahi and revelation that can actually have a more powerful, benefit from this intellectual capacity. Inshallah, we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He gives us the ability to make use of our intellectual capacities. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Beijing and its partners reportedly hope to challenge the U.S. dominance of the global communications infrastructure. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Reuters reported China's largest telecom firms are working on a massive undersea telecommunications cable network aimed at challenging the U.S. dominance in operating global internet infrastructure. Four people involved with the project told Reuters recently. China Telecom, China Mobile Limited, and China Unicom are in the planning stages of what is expected to be a $500 million undersea fiber optic project connecting Asia with the West Asia and Europe, the sources said. The sprawling network known as EMA, Europe, Middle East, Asia, is reportedly intended to compete with another cable system currently under construction by U.S. firm Subcom LLC called CMEWE6, that is Southeast Asia, Middle East, Western Europe 6. Chinese firm HMN Tech, formerly Huawei Marine Networks, was initially selected in 2020 to manufacture the cable for CMEWE6 by a consortium that included the Chinese telecoms now working on EMA. However, a sustained U.S. pressure campaign that included millions of dollars in training grants to foreign telecoms in return for switching their votes ultimately pushed the contract to HMN's U.S. competitor last year, despite significantly higher costs. The three Chinese telecoms have reportedly signed agreements with telecoms in France, Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, with further deals in the works elsewhere in Asia, Africa, and the West Asia region. The consortium hopes to bring EMA online by the end of 2025, the sources told Reuters. The advantages of such a project for China are obvious. One source told Reuters, a faster connection between China, Hong Kong, and the rest of the world not under U.S. control gives Beijing an insurance policy should they be cut off from U.S.-controlled networks. Washington has been campaigning for years to convince allies to exclude Chinese companies from future infrastructure projects. However, Reuters sources said they fear the plan presages a growing division of global internet infrastructure into what a researcher for military industrial think tank RAND Corporation described as a U.S.-led internet and a Chinese-led internet ecosystem. The more the U.S. and Chinese disengage from each other in the information technology domain, the more difficult it becomes to carry out global commerce and basic functions, RAND's Timothy Hitt told Reuters, warning that forcing third countries to choose between the two sides would make technologies like GPS satellites and online banking much less reliable. Also, according to Eurasian Times, the undersea cables, which carry the vast majority of the world's internet traffic, have become a key point of connection between the two global superpowers, as intelligence agencies can tap into the cables to carry out surveillance. Over 400 undersea cables carry over 95% of all international internet traffic globally, according to data from Telegeography, a Washington-based telecommunications research firm, as quoted by various reports. These data conduits, which transmit everything from emails and banking transactions to military secrets, are vulnerable to sabotage, attacks, and espionage, Reuters claimed, quoting an unnamed U.S. administration official and two security analysts. The undersea cables have become a new front in the ongoing U.S.-China tech war became evident in February when two communications cables connecting Taiwan with its Matsu Islands were cut, disconnecting the 14,000 residents' internet, report said on March 8.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Canada and one of the largest industrial actions in the country's history. Some 155,000 public workers are on strike in a dispute with the government over pay. While wages are a primary sticking point, the unions also want remote work included in their collective agreement. Cleaners and cooks, clerks and maintenance workers, tradespeople, Coast Guard search and rescue teams, teachers, firefighters, and workers who process employment insurance, passport applications, and immigration documents have now walked out of their jobs.
And I can tell you that we do not have a tentative agreement. The Public Service Alliance of Canada, 155,000 members, will be on strike as of 12:01 a.m. We will remain at the table. We will remain for as long as it takes during the strike. And we will remain on strike until the government addresses our key issues.
The strike has already disrupted public services in various sectors. Lawyers say the strike has affected everyone from refugee claimants whose hearings are canceled to sponsored relatives stuck in limbo and from migrant workers to foreign students. The workers' union have failed to reach an agreement with the federal government in an effort to bring the industrial action to an end. On Saturday, the Canadian government negotiators presented the striking public workers with what they called a final offer. The Treasury Board, which oversees public administration, said details are being kept to the negotiating table, but the proposal included an enhanced wage offer and addressed issues including telework, seniority, and contracting. In a statement, the Treasury Board called the offer fair, competitive, and reasonable. The offer, however, has so far failed to bring the strikes to a halt. The workers are escalating their strike action in a bid to block several Canadian ports to pressure the government to get their demands met, including raising wages in line with the cost of living crisis and the soaring inflation. This is while inflation in Canada rose to a peak of more than 8% last June. It is expected to remain above 3% until the fourth quarter of this year. The strikes in Canada come as the country is gripped with an unfathomable economic crisis that includes soaring food insecurity. A chief executive of one of the country's leading food banks, the Daily Bread, said hundreds of thousands of people stream in each month to get food.
We are absolutely in a food crisis in the country and certainly in the city of Toronto. Before the pandemic, we saw about 60,000 clients saying, I'm food insecure. And that number this past March is 270,000. It has escalated by four times, and in a country as wonderful as Canada is, it just shouldn't be that way.
Hetherington said of the newcomers to the 128 food banks across the Toronto area affiliated with the Daily Bread, many have full-time jobs but still can't make ends meet. Visitors to food banks in other parts of Canada also echo a sense of despair and need with long queues to get something to eat at food banks. Hetherington said accommodations, both rentals and homes for sales, are out of reach for many Canadians across the country. This comes at a time when a lengthy period of higher rates could force an increasing share of highly indebted Canadians to reset their mortgages at levels that squeeze their finances. But regardless of all the economic hardships the Canadian people are going through, the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau spent 1.32% of its GDP on defense in the fiscal year of 2021-2022. Canadian authorities also continue with their pledge to provide Ukraine with military support in its war with Russia. After all, Canada has been one of the most vocal supporters of Ukraine and has provided billions of dollars in financial and military assistance to Kyiv since January 2022. Apart from that, Canada is the sixth largest contributor to NATO's common funded budget by allocating 13.7% of defense spending on major equipment in 2021 and 2022. Canadian authorities claim that the assistance is for Ukraine in what they call its fight for democracy. They, however, know perfectly well that they are using billions of dollars of the Canadian taxpayers' money to inject into a war which does not serve Canada at all and only favors the expansionist policy of the United States. Instead, if this money is allocated to address Canada's internal economic concerns, what else can force more than 150,000 Canadians to walk out of their jobs and call for better pays, which would subsequently disrupt all public services and make public and private sectors dysfunctional? On a first official visit to the Islamic Republic since taking office, Iraqi President Abdel Latif Rashid has visited Tehran to hold talks with Iranian high-ranking authorities. Upon arrival, the Iraqi leader met with President Ebrahim Raisi at the Saadabad complex, where he received an official welcome by the Iranian top executive official. The two sides then held a joint press conference, with boosting bilateral relations between Tehran and Baghdad being the focus of their remarks.
With regards to political, trade and economic issues, as well as the cultural domain, we have so far had good relations in those areas, and both countries are set to further expand their mutual relations.
So it's clear and is a reality that relations between Iran and Iraq are constant and solid and unchangeable.
But enhancing trade relations and economic development was not the only issue discussed between the two presidents. President Raisi and the Iraqi leader also addressed issues concerning regional security.
A security agreement was reached between the two countries, and the slightest insecurity anywhere in Iraq is regarded as insecurity for Iran. So the security of Iraq is very important for us. The security of borders is important to us, and the security arrangements between the two countries can lead not only to the security of both countries, but the security of the whole region.
For his part, the Iraqi leader praised the role of Tehran in providing assistance to the Iraqi people during the rule of former dictator Saddam Hussein and at a time when the Arab country was gripped with foreign-backed terrorism by the Daesh terror group. The presence of foreign forces was also among issues discussed by the two presidents. President Raisi said, "As much as we consider useful the negotiations between the regional countries, we do not consider the presence of foreign forces in the region to be useful, and we regard the presence of Americans as a threat to the security of the region." Raisi said Iran's ties with Iraq and other countries of the region are based on common interests, but Americans only think of their own interests. Later on Saturday, the Iraqi president also met with the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. During the meeting, the leader called on Baghdad to get U.S. troops out of the Arab country, saying even one American soldier on the Iraqi soil is too many. Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. is not a friend of Iraq, adding that Washington is not even loyal to its European allies. The visit by the Iraqi leader to Tehran is of very high significance, both concerning Iraq's internal problems and regional and international issues. At a national level, the visit comes at a time when, according to Iran's president, the level of commercial and economic ties between the two countries exceed $10 billion, Not to mention that this figure can upgrade to a much higher level. According to President Raisi, relations between the two countries continue in various fields, including infrastructure, water, electricity, gas, and energy. These are the sectors that Iraq has been suffering the most from during the past couple of decades or so. That especially comes to the spotlight at a time when Iraq is trying to rebuild itself following its 23 U.S. invasion and the eradication of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The boosting of economic relations between Tehran and Baghdad not only will bring these two nations closer to each other, it would also help Iraq stand on its own feet after the U.S.-led war and occupation. This will also preserve the sovereignty of Iraq, given that the country has managed to be among those who have exempted themselves from the U.S. sanction measures on the Islamic Republic by continuing its trade with Tehran. After all, Iran plays a great role in developing the Iraqi infrastructure, and the presence of the Iraqi high-level delegation in Tehran can be an indication of that. In a broader perspective, Iraq has been hosting 5 rounds of negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and along with China, has facilitated the recent rapprochement between Tehran and Riyadh. That is something that would undeniably contribute to security and stability in the region. At an international level, it's not hidden to anyone that the West, namely the United States and its allies, have for decades been sowing discord and division among nations in the West Asia region to fulfill their own political and economic interests. Maybe that's exactly why these West Asian nations have come to an understanding that they should form a coalition and stand in the face of the West and its agenda, which merely aims to divide and conquer.
Iran's English language news channel, Press TV, has been targeted again. The two organizations, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, and the Center for Countering Digital Hate, or CCDH. Their accusation, in their words, Iranian state TV using social media to evade broadcast bans and spread anti-Semitic hate campaigns. That's according to their website. This is a new report that it compiled as proof that Iran's Press TV is guilty of spreading anti-Semitic hate campaigns. And this is the report. It begins with the accusation, which includes this icon, State Hate, how Iran's Press TV uses social media to promote anti-Jewish hatred. It elaborates on this and says that Press TV is a platform used to promote the Iranian state's hateful views of Jewish people, amongst other accusations. So is Press TV guilty of that? Well, for starters, if reporting on the deaths and violations of Palestinians is a crime, yes, it is. Press TV doesn't need to work that hard to cover Israeli atrocities. The Israeli regime does a good job of that, beating Palestinians, killing them, and evicting them from their homes, almost on a daily basis. Furthermore, the current fascist ministers openly threaten Palestinians, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who has called for the execution of Palestinians who act against Israel, or the Israeli finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who has called for Palestinians to be wiped out. These are genocidal calls, but the Israeli media or organizations like the ADL do not cover this. However, looking deeper into this, it becomes clear that the driving force behind this attack on Press TV are these two men, Chris Williamson and David Miller. But who are they, and why are they being targeted? ADL's attack on Press TV became clear on why it had accused it of anti-Semitism. It had targeted Chris Williamson and David Miller because of their role in the program Palestine Declassified, as stated here. In terms of the program itself, it sheds light on Israeli atrocities against Palestinians.
But academic studies have found a long-standing pro-Israel bias within the UK's broadcast media.
They're trying to do some propaganda here to bully the BBC, which has been very, very effective.
It's because they are never properly challenged.
As if that is not alarming for the Israeli regime, the host and producer both have a rich bio when it comes to their views on Palestinians. Christopher Williamson is a British politician who was a member of Parliament for Derby North from 2010 to 2015 and again from 2017 to 2019. He's been associated with many British politicians, like Jeremy Corbyn. And because of this, he has also been targeted for his role as a British MP, where he was stripped of his parliamentary pass.
Yeah, well, the first I heard about it was when I was contacted by a British newspaper called The Daily Mail. It's an absurd proposition. I mean, it's, because people may have objections to the Iranian government.
For ADL, having a former British MP hosting a TV program for Iran's Press TV exposing Israeli atrocities is just too much to bear. Then comes David Miller, former professor at Bristol University, producer and co-host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified. He was fired from the university since he said Israel is a violent, racist, foreign regime engaged in ethnic cleansing.
Because there's a huge amount of documentation going along with the case, and that's where we will find whether the university has wrongfully dismissed me, and also whether the court will determine that I was discriminated against on grounds of my political beliefs, which is the claim that we're making.
Press TV is proud to defend the rights of Palestinians and oppressed people anywhere in the world. It has done so through its inception 17 years ago, and the station has been successful in reaching the voice of the oppressed people of Palestine to the world. Even ADL admits the incredible reach of Press TV, that although it was banned from TV and YouTube, it continues to reach up to 11.5 million followers. While Press TV enjoys this high exposure, ADL's post on Twitter had a measly 26,400 views with only 78 likes. So at the end, we ask, who is winning the social media war?
Could the turmoil in Israel prove to be terminal for the Zionist entity?
For weeks, there have been a lot of talk about Ukraine's much-discussed counter-offensive against Russia. U.S. sources say Ukraine is preparing to launch a counter-offensive against Russian forces as early as next month. But it appears that Ukraine's planned military assault, originally announced for November 2022, has been postponed indefinitely. The administration of US President Joe Biden is quietly preparing for the possibility that Ukraine's spring counteroffensive would fall short of expectations. The counteroffensive will attempt to retake territory, most likely in the east and south. Publicly, President Joe Biden's team has offered unwavering support for Ukraine. Pentagon documents allegedly leaked by Airman Jack Teixeira revealed that the U.S. doesn't believe Ukraine can regain any significant territory in its counteroffensive. More current assessments also don't expect much Ukrainian success. The Biden administration officials have reportedly said they don't think Kiev has the ability to sever Russia's land bridge to Crimea in the Kherson and Zaporizhia oblasts. U.S. intelligence says that Ukraine simply does not have the ability to push Russian troops from where they were deeply entrenched. Now, the administration is expected to face criticism from hawks who believe Biden hasn't given Ukraine enough weapons, as well as those who have been calling for the U.S. to push for diplomacy. Without a decisive victory, Western support for Ukraine could weaken and Kiev could come under increasing pressure to enter serious negotiations to end or freeze the conflict.
While every hour on the battlefield counts, the delay in supplying long-range missiles to Ukraine is already significant. This does not allow us to roll back the positions of Russian terrorists, in particular from Kherson, Zaporizhia, and our other cities, which are constantly shelled by Russian long-range missiles.
American and NATO allies have supplied Ukraine with extensive artillery and ammunition for the upcoming battle. But Ukraine has no guarantees of success with a counteroffensive against Russia, despite receiving Western weapons, training and intelligence support.
Yes, still there is some disagreement, but I'm sure everybody will understand that we are in a situation of extreme urgency. I'm sure that in the following days we will reach... But while we look for this legal agreement, don't believe that we are just sitting and waiting. The whole work is going on. The whole work is going on. So, and once the legal agreement will be reached, the work, the practical work, will be finished.
According to reports, a large portion of the combat-ready, equipped and motivated cadre units of the Ukrainian forces have already been destroyed. U.S. military officials have said Western countries had managed to prepare 9 armored brigades, but experts have questioned this figure since over 830 tanks would be needed for that size of a deployment. Some experts say no more than 3 or 4 Ukrainian brigades could realistically be trained and armed by NATO and the U.S.
I said in Kyiv yesterday that Ukraine's future is in the Euro-Atlantic family, and all NATO allies have agreed that Ukraine will become a NATO member. But the main focus now is, of course, on how to ensure that Ukraine prevails.
Ukrainian officials have said their goal is to break through dug-in Russian defenses and create a widespread collapse in Russia's army. But American officials have assessed that it's unlikely the offensive will result in a dramatic shift in momentum in Ukraine's favor. Since the war began last year, the United States has discouraged peace talks and recently came out against the idea of a ceasefire in Ukraine. But now there is a discussion amongst administration officials about convincing Ukraine to accept more modest goals and agree to a temporary ceasefire. A top-secret assessment from early February stated that Ukraine would fall well short of its counteroffensive goals. More current American assessments are that Ukraine may make some progress in the south and east, but won't be able to repeat last year's success. Kyiv has ruled out negotiations with Moscow until it recaptures all the territories. But even with all Western help, big gains are not guaranteed or even necessarily likely.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Gun violence is always a critical topic during U.S. elections, but experts see little hope in the U.S. political circle to address the issue due to its historical complexity and the extremely polarized stances of Democrats and Republicans, even as gun-related tragedies continue to occur in the United States of America. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more, please. Global Times noted, in the latest reflection of the miserable situation over the past week, Alabama witnessed another mass shooting tragedy in the U.S., with 4 deaths and 28 injuries, while the potential Republican presidential candidates still reportedly rejected the idea of more restrictions that could curb the bloodshed as they spoke at the annual gathering of the National Rifle Association, NRA. The Alabama shooting happened the same day that shots were fired into a crowd at a park in Louisville, Kentucky. 2 people were killed and 4 others were wounded. That incident was the city's second mass shooting in less than a week. On April 10th, a gunman killed five people and injured several others at Louisville's Old National Bank, according to CNN. According to data released by the Gun Violence Archive, GVA, across the U.S., a total of 157 mass shootings have happened this year as of April 16th, indicating an average of 1.48 cases per day during this period. These shootings have resulted in 12,358 deaths, with 413 aged under 17 and 9,600 injuries, according to data updated recently. But former President Donald Trump still insisted that this is not a gun problem in his speech recently during NRA annual gathering. Mike Pence, Trump's vice president, also towed the line by saying that people should stop trampling on the God-given rights of the American people every time a tragedy happens, according to a New York Times report recently. Liu Xiang, a research fellow at the Chinese Academy of Social, pointed out that the issue has been totally politicized and became a label of partisan conflict in the U.S. Liu told the Global Times recently, "In the U.S., the Democrats have to call for banning or managing guns, while Republicans will definitely stress freedom in owning guns. It's as if they're not Democrats or Republicans if they do not stick to the party's stance. Such polarized stances have resulted in there being no space for the two parties to negotiate over the issue," which Liu deemed as the main reason why the problem of gun violence in the U.S. cannot be resolved as its root. "This is a typical systematic problem of the United States," Liu noted. The Insider reported, during the NRA annual meeting, photos of children handling firearms also made the rounds on U.S. social media platforms over the weekend. Even though the association said that they had rendered the guns at the exhibitions incapable of being fired, gun control advocates slammed the scene as saying responsible gun owners and parents would not allow a child to put their finger on a firearm's trigger while pointing it at other people, even if they are props. Yuan Zheng, deputy director and a senior fellow of the Institute of American Studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, said that even though gun violence is always a critical issue during the U.S. elections, they will not play a decisive role. "Gun violence is a complicated issue, combining historical and partisan elements as well as social factors. The current polarized U.S. politics is making it even more difficult to solve the problem, which is actually pathetic and indicates the government's lack of capability," according to Yuan. "The U.S. government's inability to address this mission impossible has laid bare the decline of U.S. governance capacity," according to a report China released in February, revealing the truth and facts of rampant U.S. gun violence. In June 2022, U.S. President Joe Biden signed into law what was reportedly the most sweeping legislation aimed at preventing gun violence in 30 years. Biden called the signing of the legislation a monumental day and said it was proof that Democrats and Republicans could find common ground on important issues. However, experts see this so-called gun deal as one that just scratches the surface, as it falls short of the essence of gun control measures expected by the public, such as prohibiting the manufacture, transfer, and possession of semi-automatic assault weapons, and the transfer and possession of large-capacity ammunition feeding devices, and a change to the age at which a person needs to be to purchase an assault-style weapon. They deemed the agreement as being just a joint political show put on by the Democrats and Republicans to trick the public and win votes during the midterm elections, amid an outcry over gun violence following the killing of at least 19 children and two teachers at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, on May 24, 2022.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with a number of poets and experts in Persian literature in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on Wednesday, April 5, 2023. The meeting took place on the eve of the auspicious birth anniversary of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Here, in the streets of Tehran, our most virtuous youth, like the ones whose names were mentioned, such as Arman Ali Verdi and Ruhollah Ajamian, they were truly some of our purest, most untainted, most virtuous youth, were tortured to death. But the Western world did not object at all. I mean, it didn't matter to them. Rather, they provoked people and trained them to do these things. Their radio stations and their agents teach these kinds of things. These are examples of their human rights. All of us must know the enemy today. Everyone should know the points the enemy uses as targets for its attacks. Everyone should know the strategies employed by the enemies. Everyone should know where the enemy is positioned. Just like in a military warfare is the same. If you don't know where the enemy is going to attack from, you will be deceived. If you don't know which area they plan on occupying, and if they succeed in tricking you, you will be deceived. You need to know these things. It is the same in soft warfare.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You must know what the enemy wants to do, where their target is, what their goals are, and what their strategies are. Everyone should know these and fight against these, especially the artistic and cultural circles. Poets, artists, novelists, cinematographers, architects, and those involved in various cultural fields should know that we are currently facing this plundering and onslaught of the enemy. They should pay attention to this. They need to understand what is happening, and they must also show what's happening to other people. They need to raise awareness about this, and they shouldn't be passive. Fortunately, we have a number of good poets today who are pious, kind-hearted, and believers in the religion and the revolution. Well, you are all examples of this. Fortunately, one of the good things that has been done by various organizations, those that are active in the field of art and also other organizations, is that they have helped to expand this kind of work throughout the country. Today, the opportunity exists for poets from all over the country, even those from villages and small towns, to introduce themselves and to go to centers where they can present their poetry.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The members of the Pakistani parliament are insisting the coalition government to eliminate obstacles in starting the oil trade with neighboring Iran to overcome the country's energy deficiency. MPs' voices were heard during the recent meetings of the parliamentary committees, in which lawmakers stressed upon the government officials to robust diplomacy for aggressively pursuing options to secure waivers on the oil trade with Iran.
We get 1 million liters of diesel from Iran every day. It's called so-called smuggling, and it's, I think, 50 rupees per liter as compared to here. We should open this up. The region has to open up.
The lawmakers recommended that all-out efforts should be made to secure waivers from sanctions on oil trade with Iran.
I've been saying to the government also that we should open up these borders because, like, for the first time, Iran-Afghanistan trade is more than Pakistan-Afghanistan trade. And I think if they can have it, and it's benefiting both countries, so this trade would be very good for us also.
According to the data provided by Pakistan's Commerce Ministry to the Parliament, Pakistan's trade with Iran has crossed over $2 billion, covering food, medicines, cotton, and pharmaceutical products.
This is a huge project. We are engaged in talks with Pakistani authorities over this issue, and both countries will manage to come up with a positive solution very soon.
Like the rest of the world, Pakistan is no exception to the global energy crisis, which is worsening with each passing day. Experts say Islamabad plans to buy oil and gas from Iran, but wants to do in such a way that it escapes sanctions from the US and other Western countries.
Although the bilateral trade between Iran and Pakistan has now reached over $2 billion, however, both sides believe that more efforts should be made to strengthen the trade relations further and to support the business community of the two countries. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Turk
Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar said there are positive signs that Turkey and Syria could be close to reaching an agreement that would facilitate the return of 3.6 million Syrian refugees to home. Akar talked about the meeting that took place in Moscow between him and Syrian Defense Minister Ali Mahmoud Abbas with the participation of Iranian and Russian counterparts. The Turkish minister said things will not be solved in one meeting after 11 years of strained relations. However, he says both sides are aware that through dialogue they can find common ground.
We got together with the Syrian defense minister for the first time in 11 years. It was an important meeting. Dialogue is the key. Both sides acknowledge this. It is, of course, not possible to resolve everything at once. Naturally, the parties may have maximalist demands, but we are trying to turn those demands into reasonable ones.
Damascus says its main demand is for Turkish troops to leave the Syrian territory, with officials repeating in every meeting that the road to normalization can only be paved by the withdrawal of thousands of Turkish troops from the Arab country. This point was again raised in last week's meeting and stressed by the Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad. He said it is impossible to talk about normalization as the Turkish army continues to occupy Syria's northern areas. But Turkey says its presence in Syria is aimed at fighting terrorism and creating a safe environment for the Syrian people, as well as protecting shared borders, which is Turkey's main concern. Turkey is also worried from a new round of clashes, which could lead to a new wave of refugees.
Both sides have their demands. The Turkish side wants security guarantees. They don't want to see any type of autonomous structure in the northeast of Syria that is led by the YPG group. This is a major security concern for Turkey. And Turkey also has almost 4 million Syrian refugees that it would like to slowly see repatriated in the future. We're still far apart on the demands from both sides for normalization. But this doesn't mean that both sides can't come together on a transactional basis to try to further issues that are of mutual interest.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has hoped that he can reach an agreement with Syria before the upcoming presidential and parliamentary election. Sending refugees back is one of the Turkish people's main concerns, and opposition parties are playing the card of Syrian refugees against Erdogan in their campaigns. A normalization of relations between Ankara and Damascus will definitely ease the pressure on Turkey, whether regarding the refugee crisis or armed groups operating in Syria that Turkey sees as terrorists. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iran has successfully tested a homegrown plane engine and its control system. The engine was built by experts of Mapna Industrial Group using the reverse engineering method. The testing process was observed by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, who was visiting the company on the occasion of the International Workers' Day. Raisi visited an exhibition on Mapna Group's technological achievements in the fields of thermal and renewable energy power plants, oil and gas, rail transportation, air engines, electric cars, and so forth. During his visit, the Iranian president praised the company, saying he is proud of the efforts made by skilled workers and experts of Mapna.
We must be proud of this level of work, endeavor, creativity, innovation, skill, knowledge, and technology. Truly, this company is one of the industrial groups that have made us proud. It has also made our country more powerful. They have accomplished a lot, and they have lots of important projects that will be completed in the future.
Raisi described the achievements as significant, saying the company's productions are quality enough to be sold on regional and global markets. In 2022, the Mapna Group won an award for being one of the top three Iranian exporters of the year. In July, the company's technology and engineering exports topped 2.5 billion euros.
The major achievements of the Mapna Industrial Group have once again proved that sanctions cannot hinder Iran's development. Iranians have time and again shown that where there is a will, there is a way. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Paris was on fire for May Day, International Workers' Day, once again.
Hundreds were arrested, hundreds were hurt, and tear gas was a constant for hours. The demonstration route was littered with broken glass and fires after cops repeatedly intervened in the march. Protesters targeted banks